Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. This hour, we're going to be looking at uranium in Wyoming. We'll be looking at the benefits and downsides of uranium production to Wyoming's economy. We'll hear about how the waste associated with uranium extraction is managed and the problems it can create. And finally, we bring you a three-part documentary where we try to find answers to a decades-old mystery about uranium on the Wind River Reservation.
We'll start with the business aspect of uranium for the state of Wyoming. For the last several years, a number of companies and politicians have expressed interest in getting more actively involved in Wyoming's uranium industry. Currently, a task force of lawmakers is studying nuclear energy production, and companies are testing the waters before they jump into the marketplace. The upside is that Wyoming has a lot of uranium. The downside is cost and regulations. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
Here's a quick history lesson. Wyoming has been active in uranium since the 1950s, but the golden age was the late 1970s when the industry was booming. State Senator Eli Bebout and his brother got into the industry then, and for a while it was great.
There was a lot of activity, a lot of mines were up and running, uranium was being produced, and so we got involved in the drilling business back then, and primarily in the Gas Hills, the Red Desert area. So we got started then, and of course, in 1980, Three Mile Island, and boy, it just fell off the edge of a cliff.
Three Mile Island was a nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania that suffered a mishap in 1979 that led to the release of radioactive gases that changed the way that industry was regulated and, more importantly, made the public more skeptical about nuclear power. Tex Taylor is a University of Wyoming agriculture economist who has studied the viability of the uranium industry. Taylor notes that Wyoming has more uranium than anywhere in the country, but interest in that uranium eventually faded.
At its peak in 1980, we were producing about 12 million pounds. There were nine mines, 5,300 workers. And then, of course, things like Three Mile Island happened in 1979, Chernobyl in 1986, which really chilled the market for uranium. So places like Jeffrey City essentially dried up.
Taylor says the industry has slowly come back, but instead of 12 million pounds, Wyoming is producing about 2 million. However, a number of companies are getting back into the game, and while studying the issue for Wyoming's largest producer, Cameco, Taylor concluded that the future could be bright.
Probably not going to be a huge mammoth boom sort of thing, but I think there's potential long run, if you could mine, 440 million tons of that stuff over some point in time, that would be significant employment, significant labor income, significant tax revenue.
Cameco's Ken Vaughn says they have plans to double their production. They hope to do this by adding three satellite facilities to their existing Smith Ranch Highland Mine near Douglas, which is the largest uranium operation in the United States.
These three satellites will be in Campbell County, Converse County, and one in the Gas Hills area right on the Natrona-Fremont County line. The first one to come into production will be North Butte. That will allow us, again, to double our production. It's just an exciting time for our company and for the employees who will be working for us.
But there are challenges for those companies that aren't as established. State Senator Eli Bebout says because of contamination issues in the past, state and federal permitting is now quite burdensome. He says companies can spend as much on permits as they do on getting an operation up and running. Bebout adds that there are long delays in permitting, too. Glenn Ketchpohl of Uranert Energy Corporation in Casper admits that it's frustrating and can make it difficult for companies in Wyoming to be able to compete with companies in other countries that don't face similar challenges.
When we have to compete, we like to think about a level playing field, that we're all playing by the same requirements environmentally and so on. So it's tough out there.
Ketchpohl says that upfront costs mean that the price has to be right for companies to jump full bore into uranium production. Senator Bebout fears some of these companies might find it easier to leave the state and country. So as the chairman of the Senate Minerals and Economic Development Committee, he is looking at Wyoming legislation that could reduce some permitting hurdles. Laramie Senator Chris Rothfuss, a Democrat, is on a task force studying ways to enhance Wyoming's standing in the nuclear energy field. He says he supports part of Bebout's argument.
There are some people who want it to be easier. I am not one of those people. But quicker, certainly. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years for a permit, I don't think that's good for anyone.
Rothfuss says if it's done safely and economically, he will support it. But both of those components need to be present. Nobody we talked to believes there will be another uranium boom, but all agree that future production can be an important and long-term piece of Wyoming's economy.
Everyone is predicting a uranium boom internationally, and Wyoming has the largest deposits in the U.S. The state has a legacy of uranium mining as well. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov looks at the boom and its history.
In Wyoming, there are 321 abandoned uranium mine sites, ranging from minor to major projects. A few sit on the outskirts of Jeffrey City, between Rawlins and Lander. It's easy to pass the town's empty buildings when speeding along 287. The mines there and throughout the state were exploited prior to the environmental laws passed in the 70s. 34 have been reclaimed. Outside of Jeffrey City is a site that hasn't been reclaimed yet. Frank Filas with Energy Fuels, a uranium mining company, walks off the dusty road for a better view.
What are we looking at?
Well, this is the McIntosh Pit, and that pit lake there is fairly deep.
The water is of a brilliant blue color and sits walled in by large stepped banks cut into the rock.
The water is generally of pretty good quality. Because it's a uranium mine, though, the radionuclides are above drinking water standards, but it's still pretty good water.
But it's not drinking quality water. Near the pit sits a pile of sand. The sand has uranium in it, but so little that they didn't bother processing it. The Geiger counter I brought along chirps at it.
You wouldn't have a pile like this like in downtown Laramie or something like that, but out here at a remote location, it's not causing any harm to anybody. It's not that much above background levels.
By background levels, he means the natural radiation that's present everywhere. It sounds more like this. Energy Fuels is currently working on permitting a new open pit mine at the site, similar to the pit we're standing at, along with an underground mine to accompany it. They're a minority amongst the other companies descending upon the state's uranium reserves, who mostly mine in situ. In situ uses water to dissolve the uranium underground and pump it to the surface, and is much cheaper to do. The last boom was driven by the Cold War, and prices were set by the Atomic Energy Commission. This one comes as stockpiles of uranium for an increasing number of power plants dwindle.
It won't be like the good old days where the uranium miners descended on this country in droves.
But while federal and state agencies are cleaning up the mess left behind by the previous boom, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, the Office of Surface Mining, and a smorgasbord of other agencies are already loaded down with applications for new mines. Today's industry acknowledges concerns of potential contamination, radiation, and dangers to workers, but say the post-law era is meticulous about mitigating those issues. Companies do pre-production monitoring of water and air, are checked on by regulators during production, and have to clean up sites. The land quality administrator of the DEQ, Nancy Nutbrock, says regulators work closely with companies to make sure they're adhering to the law. Essentially, they rely on the industry to self-regulate to some extent.
Given some of the limitations on our staff, and surely the number of staff that we have relative to the number of operators that are coming into the state, that working relationship has to be there and it has to be functioning at a premium.
2 years ago, the DEQ requested funding from the legislature to fund additional employees for site inspections. There was one producing mine in the state at the time. Now, according to Nutbrock, there are two producing sites and five more that are close to starting. There are 19 projects currently permitted and four pending applications. The request for more inspectors has been turned down.
That is a concern of mine. It is.
Matthew Weinschenk is senior analyst at the Wall Street Daily. He analyzes the uranium industry.
Whether you consider it good or bad, I think that we've only seen policy in the U.S. being towards more open energy production. So I don't think that we're going to see much pushback from the actual regulators to slow things down very much.
Still, development is slow. For example, Energy Fuels has about 3 more years to go in just permitting work. One of the biggest concerns right now is whether regulators can keep up with the incoming applications. Part of that slow development also has to do with prices. They're high enough for existing projects to make a healthy profit, but not so high that new projects can join them.
With uranium prices currently at $52 per pound, it doesn't make economic sense to bring these new big projects online. But if you look at all the potential uranium properties that we know about, prices would have to hit around $83 per pound for the average project to return its owners 15% return on investment, which is sort of an average threshold.
Wyoming has an advantage on this point. The state is closer to infrastructure than projects in uranium-rich Kazakhstan and even Canada, so production costs will be lower.
Even if prices don't get up, I think you still could see a rise in production coming out of the U.S. and the Wyoming areas.
That's a catchphrase. We'll believe it when we see it.
That's Vicky Howe, who owns the one local bar in Jeffrey City. It's the social hub of the ghost town. Energy Fuels obviously believes it, though. They're plowing ahead with their development. For Wyoming, more mines would mean revenues from production and jobs, direct and indirect. And for Jeffrey City, that could mean a revival.
There were 3 bars in this town because the miners couldn't party with the ranchers and the ranchers couldn't party with the oil field workers. This was the cowboy bar, the rancher bar, because the ranchers are still in business. There's a fondness for that time period.
Prices are expected to go high enough for a resurgence, but the future projects sit between the 2 old pits, the new boom sandwiched between the old, as if somehow contained for now. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
When we come back, we'll look at how the waste from uranium extraction is managed and what problems and challenges it poses. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. When the Cold War caused a uranium boom in the 1950s, soil and water in the state suffered contamination. Reclamation has improved the landscape and regulation is catching up with the industry, but it's not perfect yet. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez reports.
Ore from Wyoming's rich uranium deposits was refined and concentrated into yellowcake at mills in the state before being sent to processing and enrichment facilities elsewhere. The mills produced large amounts of sandy waste called tailings, which still contained uranium.
Uranium itself is not highly radioactive, but what it does when it's milled is to release certain radioactive elements, such as radium, which is a daughter product of uranium, and radon, which is another step in the process of radioactive decay.
That's Sam Walker, author and former historian for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Walker says the now-defunct Atomic Energy Commission was aware that radon could be dangerous to humans, cancer was one example, so they did set some rules for managing mill tailings.
As long as the mills were operating, the AEC required them to either cover the mill tailings piles or to keep them wet, and the idea of this was to keep the mill tailings, the sand-like substance, from blowing around where it might land in places where it wasn't desirable.
But that Wyoming uranium boom didn't last long, and many mills closed down by the 1960s, leaving behind open areas of dried tailings. The Susquehanna Western Mill site was built by an AEC buying station near Riverton in a floodplain between two rivers. Area residents used the sandy tailings in construction. Kids played in it. The Department of Energy moved the tailings to a controlled area decades later. But even today, some residents complain about contaminated drinking water and fear for their health.
It's a lot different today than it was then.
That's mining engineer, geologist, and consultant Doug Beam. Beam says environmental effects were not a primary concern in the early 1950s. America was positioning itself to become a world power.
You have to keep in mind that that was the Cold War. I grew up in that generation. You didn't. But we did the drills. of going to the bomb shelters. There was a different emphasis at the time.
Beam says mining contractors didn't just toss around tailings and forget about them. He worked at the Union Carbide mine in the Gas Hills in the 1970s and says tailing pools had dams to prevent acidic tailings from spilling into water drainages. However, he acknowledges that tailings ponds were meant to leak into the soil until the material became inert.
They looked at what was there, and a slow release over time, where the natural processes like radium being absorbed in clays was better than putting something in a bucket and waiting for the bucket to leak.
In 1973, Wyoming passed the Environmental Quality Act that required mines to restore mine land to its original condition or better. In 1978, Congress enacted the Uranium Mill Tailings Radiation Control Act that charged the DOE with remediating abandoned mill sites. Companies are now expected to clean up after themselves and line any new tailings ponds.
We are looking eastward towards the Pathfinder mill tailings.
It was once an open pit mine beside ponds containing 40 million tons of tailings. Now it's grassy open rangeland and some hills. The tailings have been capped with clay, earth, and rock. It looks just like an unvegetated rock formation.
That's all mine reclamation. That's not native.
There were several mining operations in this area, but as far as the eye could see, the land was restored or on its way back. Wyoming Outdoor Council's Richard Garrett examined a hill remediated with federal abandoned mine land dollars.
Well, you know, it's hard not to be impressed with the expenditure of a lot of money. Frankly, I do recognize this as a mine site, or at least a reclamation site of some kind. To me, it seems like a good application of AML funds and the DEQ's efforts. Yeah.
As the state considers a batch of permit applications for new mines, Garrett wants the industry and its regulators to exercise caution and avoid wasting resources and causing damage. Most of the mining projects seeking permits in Wyoming are in-situ leach mining operations. Instead of making an open pit or going underground to dig up ore, these efforts will seek to collect thin, low-grade uranium by essentially flushing it out of deep underground deposits. Shannon Anderson of the Powder River Basin Resource Council says in-situ mining is not without problems.
Every single uranium mining operation that's happened in this in-situ process has left the water worse off than they found it.
In-situ mining uses up a lot of water and then re-injects used water back into the ground, even though it still contains dissolved uranium and other elements. Companies and researchers are trying to make the process safer and more efficient. But Anderson says the uranium industry will have to work hard to earn back public trust and establish itself as a clean energy solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
As we just heard, the uranium industry may have a long way to go in earning back the public's trust, especially on the Wind River Reservation. In 2010, the Department of Energy released well monitoring data from the Wind River Reservation, and what they found was that uranium levels in a number of their wells had spiked up to 100 times the legal limit. In early May, the Department of Energy released tap test results showing uranium levels nearly twice the legal limit, but later said the results were anomalies.
It's generally believed these problems stem from nearly 1.8 million cubic yards of radioactive waste left behind by the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill that operated from 1958 to 1963. After a nearly year-long investigation, Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone brings us this story on how the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill got on the reservation and the people it's affecting.
The first time I met Mark Soldierwolf, he was sitting at his breakfast table drinking a Dr. Pepper, staring out the window at the white Chemtrade sulfuric acid plant water tower. This part of the Wind River Reservation is fairly flat, and the tallest structure you can see on the landscape is the water tower.
Where you see the white tower, that's my land.
Soldierwolf's wife looked out the window at the tower too, with a look that should have knocked the thing over, but it didn't. Then Soldierwolf took me down to see the land.
At the water tower is where we used to have a corral and barns for our cattle and horses for the winter time in case no snow got deep. Well, that's where we used to put them. Then we had 10 acres of oats and 10 acres of soft barley for our chickens and birds and whatever we had.
The area is now fenced off, one, because it's private property owned by Chemtrade, and two, because it's radioactive and off limits to the public. So Soldier Wolf and I look through the cyclone fence at the sparse flat land where the water tower, some small squat buildings, and a few trees now stand.
Right over here, Right where this white building is, there was a cemetery of 9 old warriors. So that's where they buried them. And that's where they bring in the uranium right through here from out there, right through here.
For around 50 years now, Mark Soldier Wolf has been telling people that the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill outright robbed him of his land. However, an employee with the current landowner, Chemtrade, angrily disputes this notion. In the summer of 1954 or 55, officials from the Bureau of Indian Affairs started coming to Mark Soldier Wolf's home.
Realty department, Lynn Jenkins and Franklin Boyd, and where there was 4 people from the agency at Fort Washakie. And the superintendent, Arnston, he came and told me that the white people wanted your land. He said they're going to improve your land, but he said they want you out of here.
Soldier Wolf says there were some other visitors from Riverton, too, newspaper men.
Peck's, Bob Peck and his brother Roy. And man, I tell you, they wanted that land so bad. They'd even send out cakes and pies, you know, trying to coax us to sign and this and that and make it easy for... I wouldn't do it.
Soldier Wolf says the group showed up again a while later, but he says the second visit was different. This time, they offered money.
Well, they said they're going to offer you $50,000. I said, I live off this land. My whole family live off this land. We've got different grains of grass for cattle and horses, plus wheat and oats. Well, he said, that don't mean anything. He said, they want your land. And we're here to see that they get this land.
Soldier Wolf says there was a third visit with a slightly higher offer of money, then a fourth and final encounter. They offered money for the last time, but Soldier Wolf said no.
And then they said, well, Mark, we got a decree for you to read. He said, you know how to read? I said, no, I don't know how to read. Well, he said, we'll read it to you. So they read it to me, this and that, this and that, this and that. Toward the end, that's when it said that this land is now under ownership of eminent domain. And he said, as of this today, they said, we want you out here within 30 days or you're going to penitentiary.
Soldier Wolf says they tried giving him the letter, but he swatted it to the ground, perhaps in some hope that what the men said wouldn't be true if he just didn't accept it. Either way, that night his father came home and found the letter.
Well, he interpreted the letter to me and he said, you know what, Mark, I don't want to tell you this, but that you have to move out of here. What do you mean, you? I said, what about you? He said, well, I'm one of you guys. He said, we're moving this land. Otherwise, we'll all go to federal penitentiary for not obeying this message.
Winter was around the corner at that time, and moving by foot in a Wyoming winter would be considered nearly impossible by most. When the spring of 1957 came, the Soldier Wolf family packed up their belongings and scattered across the reservation. Within the year, the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill had been built and was producing yellowcake, just a mile from where Soldier Wolf was forced to relocate to. Mark Soldier Wolf was born in 1931. His birth name was Mark Duck Dewey, but was adopted at birth by his grandparents, the Littles, or Little Ants as they appear on some documents. His grandmother was known as Cassie, but in Arapaho was called Red Necklace, and his grandfather, Charles, was more commonly known as Soldier Wolf, hence the name change. Things were different on the reservation then. There were a few cars, Model Ts and Model As, but mostly wagons, horses, and your feet for transportation. There were no houses or cabins of any sort, and the Arapaho lived along the rivers between generally what is now Riverton all the way towards the Wind River Mountains. But life on the reservation was changing, and for Soldier Wolf, he noticed that change when he went to mission school.
I was forced to go to school when I was 10 years old. We were forced to speak white. If we did speak Indian in these schools, they'd take us away and they'd beat the hell out of us, take our clothes off, and they'd put us in certain rooms. And we'd stay there for about a day or two, actually incarcerated in those little rooms.
Soldier Wolf's first language is Arapaho, but as he grew up, he learned what little English he could in school and then in the military. Soldier Wolf joined the Marines in 1948, completed basic training in California, then made his way through Japan, Guam, the Philippines, and eventually Korea, where he served directly under General Douglas MacArthur.
Well, I wasn't just the only one, but there were a lot of other Indian boys that was around him all the time. Because he considered the Indians the most fearless warriors.
Soldier Wolf even crossed the 38th parallel into North Korea with MacArthur, fighting some of the bloodiest battles of the war with the general before MacArthur was relieved of duty by President Truman. When Soldier Wolf returned to Wind River in 1952, he settled down and got married. He worked a number of odd jobs while he was home, Ironically, one of those was helping prospectors search for uranium deposits on the ground with Geiger counters and scintillators, which became the first time he began to hear anything about a mill from one of the gangs he was working with.
So they came over and asked me, he said, do you own this land by the railroad track? And I said, no, not really. I said, I own land up to the corner. Oh, he said,
As we now know, those conversations continued and led to the acquisition of Soldier Wolf's land for uranium development.
When we come back, we bring you part two of our investigation on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. We've been talking about how the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill got onto the reservation, and we return now to the second part of our investigation. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Ottone.
If there's a crime, there's a motive. To anyone driving around the Wind River Reservation, where the Riverton site sits, there's nothing particularly special about the land. Mark Soldier Wolf, his relatives and ancestors had farmed their allotments before Susquehanna Western built there. But why would the uranium millers pick that spot out of all other places on the reservation or in Wyoming, for that matter? For answers, I turn to Robert Gregory, a uranium geologist with the Wyoming State Geological Survey.
From what I understand, it was chosen primarily because it was close to some ore deposits, primarily the Gas Hills. They were recently discovered at that time in the early 50s. There were also deposits in northern Wyoming.
According to Gregory, the Soldier Wolf's land also offered a number of valued items, an available workforce, access to highways and railways, and water. In other words, it's an ideal piece of land for a mill that was feeding the rapidly expanding uranium industry at the time.
It was originally started as a buying station where the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, would buy ore, and then they would take it elsewhere to process it into yellowcake, and then eventually it became a processing mill there where they produced yellowcake as well.
In 1958, Wyoming had three authorized uranium mills, one of which was operating, and two, including Susquehanna Western, were getting ready to start producing. With places like Susquehanna starting off as buying stations, Gregory says it was likely that operators at the Riverton site realized it would be more profitable for the company to produce yellowcake instead of just selling unprocessed ore.
If you have to ship ore itself, it's costly to move the ore. But if you can dig it up and, for example, only move it from the Gas Hills to the Riverton site and then leave all the tailings there, it's just cheaper. You can produce the yellowcake, and that's got a higher value in it.
On top of that, the mill filled an economic need the state was desperately trying to fill at the time. In 1958, Roy Peck, one of the visitors Soldier Wolf claims approached him for his land, testified before Congress on the need for additional government help to produce uranium for the nation's growing atomic weapons arsenal. Introduced as Mr. Uranium by Wyoming Senator Frank Barrett, Peck told Congress that public and private capital had been invested in exploring and developing ore, and that the industry had been encouraged to reach its present state of development at the behest of the Atomic Energy Commission. He also said,
"Our proven reserves in central Wyoming exceed 11 million tons. To mill this measured reserve in 10 years would require about 3,500 daily tons of capacity, or an additional 2,000 tons of milling capacity. This uranium reserve had been drilled out prior to November 1, 1957, and as has already been indicated, present proven reserve figures are greater than this and still growing."
His takeaway message? Without congressional support and action, the state's uranium industry could collapse unless more milling capacity was granted by the Atomic Energy Commission, which had instituted caps for how much uranium could be milled in the state. As a result of pressure from industry, over a dozen mills operated around the state at different times in order to feed the nation's nuclear need. Again, Robert Gregory.
Nuclear power for electricity wasn't so much the factor as military purposes, you know, building atomic bombs. But they also knew that the power that could be gained from nuclear energy could be put to civilian use as well. But initially, like in the late 40s, early 50s, it was all about the nuclear weapons program.
In Wyoming, the uranium boom began when significant discoveries were found in the Powder River Basin in 1951, followed by finds in the Gas Hills, Shirley Basin, and a number of other places around the state. At the time, uranium prices were set by the Atomic Energy Commission, primarily because the agency's nuclear weapons program didn't have enough ore, so prices were guaranteed to encourage people to go out and find deposits. Of course, once the ore was found, it had to be processed. From earth to enrichment, uranium ore had to be dug up, turned to yellowcake, and enriched to weapons or fuel grade. Less than 1% of usable material naturally occurs in uranium deposits, and for it to be used, it had to be purified up to 85% before it was weapons grade, which is known as U-235.
You're getting a little bit of material out of a lot of rock, and then from that you have to enrich it down to weapons grade material. So it's a lot of ore itself to produce enough U-235 for a nuclear weapon.
That made Susquehanna Western the second stop in a long process from a rock to a bomb that could level a city. And ironically, the mill's construction offers another twist to Mark Soldierwolf's story. Because jobs were and are scarce on the Wind River Reservation, Soldierwolf eventually worked at Susquehanna Western, moving the mill's tailings onto the land it would eventually contaminate.
They had four rows of tailings all the way from one, two, three, four different grades, And that's where I used to work on the outside with a front-end loader. There were great big K7s, Caterpillar type.
Soldier Wolf seems healthy today and shows none of the health impacts other uranium miners and millers have experienced around the country. Because he worked outside, he says he may have lucked out by only being exposed to the dust that came off the ore when it was brought in on trucks to the plant uncovered.
My brothers and cousins and all those other guys, Indian boys from the local area, worked there. They had good money. Later on, I learned that they were quitting because they were getting bad health.
Soldier Wolf says he remembers 12 Arapahoes who worked in the mill that later got sick and died.
And one of them was my brother. His name was Elijah. And he died for no reason at all. He just went to bed and didn't wake up.
That was nearly 40 years ago. What we now know is what Soldier Wolf was seeing was radiation poisoning. Here's Doug Briggy, a professor at Tufts University School of Medicine.
The fact that they were in danger was known by the late 1940s. It was clear that radon was the primary risk factor for developing lung cancer in underground uranium miners.
But the difference between dangers for miners and millers is that there's not as much research on mill workers as those working underground digging the ore out of the earth. Even today, Briggy says there's nothing really conclusive.
I still think that a reasonable person at that time frame would have said, okay, these are substances that are hazardous in some other contexts. We should probably be concerned about them with regard to a mill as well.
And because the U.S. government was the only entity that could buy uranium, Briggy says when it comes to health, things could have gone differently.
There is some substantial culpability that resides with the U.S. government, in my opinion, because they ran the whole show, and all they had to do was say, we're willing to pay a little more, and we expect you to do these extra safety precautions.
Beyond that, Susquehanna Western may not have been operating at even a reasonable level of safety standards. Former High Country News reporter Marjane Ambler.
It was pretty scary. The Atomic Energy Commission back as early as 1959 was telling the mill operators not to provide evidence of health problems or accidents or overexposure to radiation for whatever reason.
In the 1980s, Ambler was working as a reporter for High Country News covering energy issues in Indian Country, and specifically health problems in Navajo uranium workers and millers at Susquehanna Western on Wind River when she was approached by a whistleblower.
I found a mill worker who had worked at Susquehanna Western by the name of Bob Haddenham, and Bob knew all along that something wasn't right about the way the mill was being run. So he saved all kinds of documents.
Things like a memo prepared by a consulting engineer for Susquehanna, Dr. G.V. Beard, telling mill operators not to give employees copies of their radiation tests. When Ambler was approached, Haddenham was in bad health. His hair was falling out. He blacked out in the middle of sentences, and he had seen nearly everyone he had worked with at Susquehanna die.
The drinking fountains sometimes wouldn't work, and when they took it apart, they would discover that it was clogged with yellowcake.
Ambler's reporting also found workers were given cloth respirators, but sometimes weren't cleaned and would still be caked with residue the next day when they came to work. As well, some millers wouldn't wear them at all when working with the product.
One worker said he'd take a mandatory shower at work, but then when he got home, he'd take another shower, and the whole base of the shower was yellow. So obviously the water that they were taking the shower with at the mill was dirty.
Eventually, Mark Soldierwolf quit working at Susquehanna Western, and after only 5 years in operation, so did the plant. They closed in 1963. When Susquehanna closed, those tailings, the crushed-up rock that had gone through the chemical processing, was left behind on the land for nearly 30 years, out in the open, then dug up and reburied in the Gas Hills in 1988, when the Department of Energy deemed them to be hazardous. As he looks out over his old homeland from behind the cyclone fence, Soldier Wolf remembers moving those tailings around on his land with a front-end loader before they got moved. But he also remembers something else that got moved when the DOE sent the 1.8 million cubic yards of tailings to its secure location 60 miles away, his relative's cemetery.
There was about five families that were buried there, too, and they ducked those out, too, and put them in the semis and took them out to the gas hills on the semi-trucks.
We were still waiting on documents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and still no closer to the truth about how Susquehanna Western got on Mark Soldier Wolf's land. If there was a crime, we had a motive. The land was an ideal place for a processing plant, but what we really needed was another eyewitness in lieu of documentation. Soldier Wolf claimed that Wind River Superintendent Arthur Arnston, Realty Department Representatives Lynn Jenkins and Franklin Boyd, and Bob and Roy Mr. Uranium Peck came to see him, and after a lot of searching, we found that everyone was dead, except for one. And he politely introduced himself the moment I walked into his nursing room apartment.
My name is Lynn W. Jenkins. I am retired. I have been retired since 83.
Lynn Jenkins is 92 years old. He lives in Lander, suffers from severe neuropathy, and according to Jenkins, in his lifetime, he spent 20 years working for the post office, nearly a decade in the uranium industry, worked several years for the Realty Department on the Wind River Reservation, handling oil and gas leases and buying and selling Indian land, and when he quit his job with the tribes, served as foreman at the Susquehanna Western Mill. As Jenkins recalls it, he remembers Scott Dewey, Mark Soldier Wolf's father, as the primary seller when Susquehanna, originally Fremont Minerals, came to Wind River to purchase the land in 1957. But in order to sell it, Jenkins says they had to get deeds to the land signed by all the heirs to the allotments.
That deed might have been circulating for three or four months before we get all the people. They were all over.
And did Jenkins go to that piece of land like Soldier Wolf claims?
Yeah. I went down to appraise it, and they paid for it.
According to Jenkins, at the time, Indian allotments could not be sold by a native person to a non-native person except under a special provision. If an Indian came to Jenkins and could prove he was competent, in other words, prove he or she could pay taxes on the allotment and maintain it, Jenkins would issue that individual a fee simple patent, meaning the holder of the patent owned the land without having to deal with government oversight. As Jenkins recalls, this process was used regularly to get people off of their land.
You know, the Indians weren't very much thought of back then, and get them off, and one thing or another, where we get the land under taxation. And that's how come you find white men and white land spotted all over the reservation. Those Indians got to be patents to their land.
In case you didn't catch that, Jenkins said to get Native people off their land, the Bureau of Indian Affairs would issue fee patents and then acquire the land to sell to non-natives when taxes weren't paid. According to Jenkins, during his time working for the tribe's realty department, his office found approximately 85% of the reservation competent, which raises a question, how many of those competent Indians actually held on to their allotments?
I never knew of one success story. A long time is out there for 10 years. We should lot of fee patents. I never found one success story. I used to say they're all sold for a bottle of booze.
Jenkins adds that that assessment isn't entirely true. He says sometimes individuals would get up to $15,000 to $20,000 for their allotment. In the case of Mark Soldier Wolf, his father Scott Dewey was a tribal council member, which meant that to the realty office, Dewey was seen as more than competent, and Jenkins says he worked with the BIA office in Billings and the Wind River superintendent to secure his land.
We didn't have to go through that process because this sale had been approved all the way up, see? So all we had to do was go from Scott directly to Susquehanna. We could bypass the signing of a deed and a fee patent, and that's what we did.
In other words, Jenkins helped to negotiate a sale of the land between allotment owners and Fremont Minerals. So did Scott Dewey actually ask Jenkins for a fee patent?
In essence, he did. But in this particular case, the Peck boys and the superintendent and he were all in the same boat. Yeah, there was no problem with him. He was very agreeable to it. because he got a lot more money, and he realized that.
As for the Pecks, Jenkins never made it very clear about their level of involvement. He had worked extensively with them searching for uranium during the boom, and as noted, they were heavily involved in the state's growing industry. However, when it comes to Susquehanna, we're left only with conjecture. Again, Lauren Jost of the Riverton Museum.
Wouldn't surprise me if they tried to buy it. Bob and Roy Peck were partners in the Riverton Ranger newspaper, and they were both avidly pro-development, and their names became closely involved with the uranium industry. I know that Roy Peck spoke at the dedication of the Susquehanna Mill when it was opened.
So what about the documents we had found, like the one that reads,
Mark Dewey is one of the families forced to relocate as a result of the uranium mill at St. Stephen's.
I showed Jenkins the document, and he read it back to me.
Mark Dewey is one of the families forced. Now, who wrote this letter? J-E-N-K-I-N-S. Well, what do you know? I wrote the letter. Why would I get away with something like this? Is one of the families forced? Forced. Well, the family's forced. That indicates that they went against their will, doesn't it?
I would think so.
That's exactly what it means. Get the hell off of there. Forced. I would say vacate. He and his family had to vacate. Why? Because the land had been sold. They had sold the land. That's all there is to it.
Then if it was sold, where did the money go? Soldier Wolf says no one in his family ever saw a penny.
I've got a strong suspicion that if you follow the money trail, you'll find it leads right to Mark. My suspicion is strong. What has he to gain for it? He had no legacy, he hadn't a damn thing.
If you didn't think so before, this is where things get murky.
In a moment, we bring you the conclusion to this story. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. In this hour, we've devoted our attention to the issue of uranium in the state, particularly how the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill got on the Wind River Reservation before it left behind radioactive waste that's still affecting the community. We now bring you the conclusion to this story.
Jenkins' admitted role in the acquisition of land for the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill ranks him as a definite person of interest. But we have to give the same amount of scrutiny to the Soldier Wolf family in this story. Indeed, Jenkins' signature shows up on nearly every single document we found, including the Freedom of Information Act documents the Bureau of Indian Affairs finally sent us. But in the documents, we also found Scott Dewey's signature, Mark Soldier Wolf's father, right next to Jenkins, as well as consents to sale from everyone in the family, including Mark Soldier Wolf. Meet Deb Donahue, professor of Indian law at the University of Wyoming.
Jenkins and apparently Scott Dewey talked to the owners of these parcels and got their agreement that they wanted to sell and filled out the forms. And the superintendent sent that information, all those documents, along with documentation that was required to the area director and then from the area director to the commissioner, and requested that BLM issue a patent to Fremont Minerals.
We gave the documents we found to Donahue to review, and her final analysis, nothing seems to be out of order or illegal about the entire sale. I'll repeat that. Nothing in the documentation points to anything illegal about the sale of allotments to Fremont Minerals. However, Donahue adds that the sale does raise certain moral and ethical questions, even if it doesn't raise legal issues. For instance, the issue of time frame in which consent to sales were filled out, the time allowed for talking and negotiating with the landowners and getting them to sign away their allotments all happened in a matter of about 2 months. Donahue questions what kind of informed consent the Soldier Wolf family could have had given the circumstances.
They didn't have attorneys. The time was so short. I saw one female heir that had a high school education, one who had 2 years of high school education, and the others all had an eighth grade education.
As well, two heirs under the age of 18 signed consent forms to Fremont Minerals. So if we take Jenkins' advice and follow the money, the BIA made no indication that money was paid. No check stubs and no trail to follow except for what the land was appraised for, $17,000 for 200 acres, and statements from the landowners about what they would use the money for.
You know, to purchase a new home, purchase machinery, household furnishings, and that sort of thing. I mean, they got one lump sum from Fremont Minerals, a check, you know, for the total amount owed, and so BIA would have been responsible for divvying it up.
In other words, money may have been paid, but again, there's no indication of it. So did people get checks, or did they go to trust accounts? One thing is clear. Over the years, the government did not keep very good track of money it paid to Native people. So who knows? On top of that, the amounts involved for the land in question weren't very much. Then there's one more issue with getting consent from the owners that's still at play today.
They did not have full information because even the BIA didn't have full information, for instance, about the potential for water pollution.
On review of the documents for the sale to be approved, the Bureau of Indian Affairs had to be able to say there would be no water pollution. But what Donahue found is they weren't sure.
So the only thing they knew about the potential for water pollution was the company's statement that they didn't think there would be any.
Why is this? Because they never got a U.S. Geological Survey report about the potential for water pollution. So the BIA did not have the very documents and evidence that they needed to justify the purchase and building of Fremont Minerals / Susquehanna Western and moved ahead. It's unclear if that report ever showed up or was even authored since it wasn't included in the documents the BIA sent us.
And yet, at the same time, well, actually before that, in July 17th, Superintendent Arnston said, "We feel this conveyance will be in the best interest of the Indian landowners and the Indian people as a whole in the community and on the reservation." What's happened since then puts that in a different light.
And what's happened since then is groundwater that's been rendered undrinkable due to uranium contamination, uranium showing up in tap water, spikes in contaminants being monitored by the Department of Energy, and a lot of reports of increased rates of cancer, thyroid disorders, and birth defects in people and animals. However, in the case of Mark Soldierwolf and his story of how the land went from his hands to Susquehanna Western, we're left with more questions and answers.
It's an unsatisfying ending, I suppose, for us, but probably not nearly as unsatisfying as for the people who are directly involved. But it's probably not an atypical story in the history of federal Indian law. Federal Indian law is not known for its certainty or its predictability, or for that matter, for the fairness of the results that it produces.
According to Donahue, nearly two-thirds of Indian allottees in the United States lost their land to non-natives. And even Jenkins said he had found about 85% of Wind River competent to own and sell their land, but never found one success story with the land they owned. There is one more thing. Mark Soldierwolf. Did he and his family get compensated for the land? He continues to say no, and has offered to provide us with all information on his trust account to see if money was ever dropped in, and will initiate an additional request to the BIA to prove that he was paid, leaving the burden on the government to show that a check was cut to the family. In the meantime, we will see if we can track down the missing USGS report from 1957 on the potential for water pollution, and additional documents that may help us make sense of the problems Soldierwolf and his community face now that the mill is gone. For residents around the former Susquehanna Western uranium mill site, the events that brought the mill to the reservation may never be fully understood, and its leftover waste and contamination won't go away in their lifetime or perhaps even the next generation. For the rest of us, this event is over as soon as we forget about it, and look forward to the future development of uranium reserves around the state. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tristan Ottone.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site. And if you go through the site, you can find ways to sign up for our new podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button.
And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter under the names ButterBob, T. Otone Martinez, RL, and Willow Belden. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.